KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the I Speak Life annual World AIDS Day observance. On Monday, December 1st, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the United Way Building, 619 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. This year's activities include a reception at 6 p.m. The film, Who Will Speak for Me?, a celebrated documentary profiling Pastor Rene Ward, and a panel discussion after the film. Again, that's I Speak Life to observe World AIDS Day, Monday, December 1st from 6 to 9 p.m. at the United Way Building in Portland. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Ed Melnick, host of the singer-songwriter edition of the Monday Sampler, on the first Monday of every month between 2 and 4 p.m. I'd like to invite you to join me on December 1st for a very special Monday Sampler. In the second hour of the show, we'll be featuring Bob Dylan and the band, The Complete Basement Tapes. In this one-hour special, you'll hear many of the songs from the Basement Tapes, as well as insights from Dylan's biographer, Clinton Halen, producer Steve Berkowitz, and many others. Rita Houston narrates, tying the whole thing together. That's Monday, December 1st at 3 p.m. right here on the Monday Sampler.
Be a part of Giving Tuesday on December 2nd. A day that inspires personal philanthropy and encourages bigger, better, and smarter charitable giving during the holiday season. KBOO is excited to participate, and we have a $5,000 match for the month of December. All new memberships and additional donations made by current members will be matched. If you gave $60 last year and decide to give $100, it will be matched for the $40 increase. If you give monthly and give an additional one-time gift, that amount will be matched. Go to kboo.fm/give to make your donation now. And thank you to the Juan Young Trust, Vernier Software, SSI Shredding Systems, and the Wendy Foundation for empowering KBOO with their matching contributions. Thank you for your support.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Paula Kaplan. Paula is a clinical and research psychologist who has done landmark work showing the unscientific and harmful nature of psychiatric diagnosis. She is a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Women in Public Policy Program and the author of 12 books, most recently, When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home, How All of Us Can Help Veterans. So welcome to Madness Radio, Paula Kaplan.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Now, Paula, you've been on the show before. You've been doing great work around psychiatric diagnosis and critiquing the DSM, looking at bias and how it's both harmful and unscientific. And so I encourage people to go to the Madness Radio archives, and you can listen online to the past interviews that we've done with you. And your most recent book is called When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home, How All of Us Can Help Veterans. And you've been focusing on the mental health of veterans, alternatives, and working with vets. Now tell us, how did you get interested in working with vets from your work around psychiatric diagnosis?
Well, in 2003, in the early spring, I was at a conference of the Association for Women in Psychology. It's a wonderful organization, and you don't have to be a woman or a psychologist to join. And Maureen McHugh, who was the head of AWP at the time, said in a meeting, "We all know that this war in Iraq is going to happen, and everybody's worried about it. Is there anything that we as psychologists specifically can do?" And when she said that, I hadn't been thinking about the war very much, except to be upset about it. But I suddenly had this image. It was like watching a movie screen. And I saw these hordes of what would be the new veterans coming back from this next war, emotionally devastated, as so many of them are. And I thought, oh, I know what's going to happen. It's terrible. Because since the previous war, our country has become even more psychiatrized than ever. And I knew what would happen. Not only therapists, but the whole country would look at these emotionally suffering vets and say, oh, we know what that is. That's a mental illness. It's post-traumatic stress disorder. And we know what to do about it. You send them to therapists and give them drugs. And you know what? That's exactly what's happened on a much larger scale than I had even feared. Because I tell you something, one of the last places I ever thought that I would end up having an appointment is at the Pentagon. But I met with some people in the Pentagon a few months ago when the book came out. And in listening to them and hearing how concerned they all were about the vet's suffering, I thought, they see more of that up close than anybody else. And what did they do? They said, essentially, well, emotional suffering, we have to do something to help these vets. Who knows how to help emotional suffering? And they looked to the traditional mental health system. It's understandable that they would do that. The traditional system has great press. You know, they persuade people that everybody who's upset needs therapy and that the therapy will help, and that everybody who's upset needs drugs and that those will help and not hurt. And I want to make it clear, I think some therapists do terrific work, and even with veterans, but they need a lot more than therapy.
Yeah, that is the basic equation, that we need more treatment, more access to services. We need to give veterans coming back who are suffering, all of them need to have therapists and doctors and get a diagnosis and get into treatment services. And you're saying that there's actually a deeper story here, and that's actually a really problematic way of looking at the issue.
Well, it is, because let me tell you this. When I wrote the book, I interviewed veterans from World War II right through to the present wars. And of all of the veterans that I listened to then, and I only have found one vet who said that a therapist was helpful in dealing with what he had experienced at war. And most of them say either the therapists were terrible. Some of the military therapists are quite good, but some of them say, oh, you're just saying you're upset so you won't have to go back into combat. But, you know, even the ones that said the therapists were helpful, like I remember one woman said, well, I saw a therapist and she was a nice lady, but, you know, I don't live in her office. I live out there in the community. So even if you go to a therapist who's terrific and who's supportive and caring and doesn't do anything harmful, the fact is that you're talking to them behind a closed door, and the rest of the country hasn't a clue what you've been through. See, 93% of Americans have never even served in the military, never mind serving in a war. And so whatever our politics, and I sincerely mean that, whatever our politics, we need to know that when our country is sending people to war, we need to know what that really means. What is the experience of going to war and then trying to come back to a culture that is vastly different?
So, Paula, give us a sense of what kinds of emotional consequences war is having on veterans. I know the suicide rates are really high. And what are some of the impacts that war has on returning veterans from a mental health standpoint?
In one of the chapters of the book, the second chapter is called Being a Veteran. And since we're a war-illiterate nation, most of us don't have any idea what war really is, I wanted to give people a sense of what vets experience. And in that chapter, I talk about the eight plagues of combat. And these are the eight emotional plagues. And it includes, well, the obvious ones, you think about them, grief, a fear, shame. Either shame because they don't feel they did enough as a warrior, or because they get over there and they realize that they don't agree with what's going on over there. And so shame at what they've done or what they feel they participated in, which leads to moral anguish, existential conflicts. They experience a loss of innocence. A lot of the people who go to war have just been at their high school prom. And so instead of going off to college or getting a job or traveling around the country or just being a young adult, all of a sudden they are confronting death. They are supposed to focus solely on defending, attacking, and destroying, killing. And so the loss of innocence that they experience when they see a buddy get blown apart, or when they realize they've killed a child, is just unbearable, and nobody should have to go through that. You've got stories about 18-year-old kids who are going into combat zones, and so they write what are called death letters. Soldiers have always written these. They, in their pocket, they keep a letter to be given to their loved ones in the case that they die. I have listened to veterans and to service members and to people who were in the service and have gone AWOL. Just about everyone, whatever their politics, however they feel about the war that they were in or the wars that they were in, just about everyone has a story of being betrayed, of being lied to. And it starts for many of them with what the recruiter told them, what they promised them they would get. You won't go into combat. You'll get a bonus, a monetary bonus. You'll get such and such kind of training. And then it turns out that's not true, or they have to give back the money when they leave the service.
I'm thinking about a friend from high school years when I was growing up in Florida who enlisted in the Army, and he wanted to be a Russian translator. He was very excited about learning Russian, and he could learn this skill and come back out of the Army and have a career. And they said, oh, yes, you'll go to Russian translator school. And they promised him that he would learn Russian translating. And so sure enough, he arrived in the Army, came out of basic training, went to Russian translating school, and he got there to the first class. And in the first class, he said they flunked out 99% of the people who were in the class. And then he was driving trucks in Germany for the rest of his tour in the Army.
You know, disproportionately, the current military is composed of people from poor families. And so for a lot of them, they see it as a way to earn a living, a way to send money back home to the family. And when they get in there and they realize that either the money they were promised isn't going to come through, or they have to do things that they were told they would not have to do, like one person was told, we will teach you vehicle repair. And this person thought, well, that'll be great, because then I can fix my own car and fix my, you know, my friend's cars and so on. And well, the vehicle repair was in Iraq, and the repair was to vehicles that had been blown apart by IEDs. And I'm sorry, some of your listeners may want to just brace themselves. What she described was when she was fixing these vehicles, there were bits of the bodies of the people who'd been in the vehicles. So you may be told that you're going to be prepared for the career that you want, and then often that doesn't happen. Now, I also want to say sometimes it does happen. And there are veterans who have said, I got what I wanted out of the military with respect to training for a future career, but some do not have that experience.
Is it true that the unemployment rate is actually higher among veterans than non-veterans?
Yes, right. And you see, there are lots of reasons for that. We still live in a racist country, and our military today is disproportionately Black and Hispanic, and so, you know, they were statistically more likely to have trouble getting work because of racism intervening than the white soldiers. But the white soldiers aren't getting jobs either.
And there's also a romanticization with the advertising and the sort of excitement and adventure that's promised. But the reality is something very, very different.
That's right. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned that. As I say, I've interviewed veterans from all wars since World War II, and I've interviewed vets who are very very strong supporters of the war or wars that they fought in, and others who are not. And it doesn't matter. Every single one of them says, even if I joined up because my grandfather and my father served in the military and served proudly, and I played with thousands of toy soldiers when I was a kid, and I was fascinated by military history, and then you go through basic training, and you go through advanced training, And every one of them says, in spite of all that, absolutely nothing can prepare you for what war is like. I just met a man named Shad Meshad, who's based in L.A., and right after the Vietnam War, he was a Vietnam vet, he created the whole model of putting vets in touch with other vets, because at least that way they could talk to somebody who they knew would get it, you know, because they'd been through it too. And they created the vet centers, which are these storefront places that are, they're part of the VA system, but a vet who has a chance to go to a vet center where you can hang out with other vets, and it's a, it's much more informal, and there's less treating of you like you're crazy and throwing drugs at you, that they'd rather go to a vet center than to the, to any place else in the VA. There's a military culture, and you have to become part of that military culture where the aims are to defend, attack, destroy, and kill, and follow orders and work within a hierarchy and with your buddies and so on. And then all of a sudden you're back in the States where you're not supposed to operate by defending and having these hair trigger responses. You hear a truck backfire and you hit the floor. You're not supposed to assume that somebody that you don't know might be your enemy. You're not supposed to be obviously attacking and destroying and killing. And you're not supposed to operate within a strict hierarchy and giving orders and taking orders. So, you know, I thought one time that about a woman that I knew. She was an undergraduate at a major university, and she was very happy. And her junior year, she went to South America. And she had an absolutely wonderful time there. Then she came back to her university and the same friends that she knew from before. She felt like such a different person because of having been immersed in another culture for a year. And she looked at her old friends and she thought, they don't know who I am anymore. And I don't know how to convey it to them, because unless I could immerse them in the culture I was in, they won't get who I am. It was devastating for her. Well, when the other culture isn't in South America, but is a war zone, then just imagine the trauma of having to make that cultural switch. And, you know, we spend months immersing the military in all the rules of war and the procedures they go through and the customs they're supposed to follow and the written and unwritten rules. When they come back home, there is no equivalent of debriefing or reacculturating them as when they go over there. And so people look at them and they see the same person and they assume that you're just like you were before. And so this creates chasms. Isolation is maybe the most devastating effect of having been at war and coming home. And so veterans will come back, and you know what they tell me? They say, almost nobody asks, how was it for you? They'll say, if people ask only one question, you know what it is? I just find this chilling. It's, did you kill anybody? And then they say, there is no good answer to that question.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and we're speaking with Paula Kaplan. She is a clinical and research psychologist who has done landmark work showing the unscientific and harmful nature of psychiatric diagnosis. She's a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Women and Public Policy Program and the author of 12 books, most recently, When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home, How All of Us Can Help Veterans. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon.
And so when they come back, there are three main reasons they become isolated. One is that they're afraid we'll think they're crazy, and I want to talk about that in a minute. They've often been called mentally ill. They've been told if you're emotionally devastated because you've been at war, then that's PTSD. It's in the diagnostic handbook. That's a mental illness. You need therapy and drugs. So they're afraid that we will think they're crazy or that we will see that they're crazy, because they often believe they are. Second reason they become isolated is after what they've been through, they are afraid of upsetting us by telling us. And the third is that they are afraid, what if I do try to tell a civilian what I went through, and what if they don't get it? Then the chasm will be even greater. And then on their side, civilians who aren't therapists, I've heard them say, "Well, I don't ask Beth anything. I don't try to get them to talk. I don't tell them I'm willing to listen because I'm not a therapist." And I want to say, you know, I hear this all the time. People will say, "Her boyfriend dumped her and she was really upset, but I didn't talk to her because I'm not a therapist." And I want to say, we used to call this friendship. We used to call it human connection. What has happened to this country, and increasingly other countries, that when we see someone that we know is probably in pain, we think, don't give them a chance to talk, don't offer to connect, because you won't know what to do because you're just a human being. Let me tell you what the wisest therapist who works with vets said to me. Remember I said that only one veteran of all the ones I've listened to said that a therapist actually helped them? The therapist was a man named David Collier. He's a psychologist at the Vet Center in Salem, Oregon. And I called him and I said, "Dr. Collier, I want to ask you something." I said, "This vet who said that you helped him, I know what he said you did that was helpful, but I want to hear from you. From your viewpoint, what do you think you do that's helpful?" And he said, "Well, I listen. I listen with all my concentration. I tell them they don't have to get it all out at once. I will be here. They can come back. When they're getting swamped with feeling, I say, just stop and breathe." And I said to him, "That's really interesting because that's exactly what the vet you helped said was helpful." And then I said to him, "And I want to ask you this." I said, "What is it that you do that's helpful to vets that a non-therapist could not do?" And he said, "Absolutely nothing. Anybody can do what I do that's helpful." And I said, "Well, what about all the techniques that some therapists use, the eye movement desensitization, cognitive behavior therapy?" And he said, "Sometimes those are helpful, but when they help, it's mostly because of the relationship between the two people." And then he went on to say, you know, about this matter of non-therapists feeling they can't help, he said, "In our training as psychologists, we pussyfoot around. We use words like empathy. You have to learn to show empathy for the person." He said, "But it's really about love." Now, when you say it that way, instead of this medicalizing, this person has PTSD and it's a mental illness and send them for therapy and drugs, the approach is very, very different. And when you look at the suicide rates for vets, when you look at the rates of homelessness and substance abuse and family breakdown, which are only going up since these current wars started, and the VA top brass and the top brass in the military are issuing press releases. I document all this in my book. If you start with when we went into Afghanistan and you trace these press releases from the military and the VA, what you see is time after time after time they're announcing a new initiative. We're hiring more therapists. We're referring more people for treatment. We've got these new programs. And then what happens in the next press release? We don't know why these rates keep going up of suicide and of substance abuse and on and on. And so, well, the fact is something more is needed because you have millions of veterans who are still suffering. And that's where the Welcome Johnny and Jane Home Project comes in, which is my cost-free idea that we need to wipe out our nation's war illiteracy. We need to make sure that the 7% of our citizens who have been in the military, and many of whom have been at war, know that they live in communities where people know their stories, where people know what war is really like, and know how hard it is to try to come back home and make that huge cultural shift and get over the sense of betrayal at many levels. Many vets don't ever get over all of that, and we have no idea of knowing how many, but there are many vets who live in the mountains and the woods in this country and never come near other people except when they have to get food or something essential. And so when we look at the rates of homelessness, they're not even counted because we don't know how to track them. So there are there's tragedy of epic proportions in this country and untold amounts of pain, and it's transforming this country in ways that we don't even begin to understand. So what I want people to do, I want every civilian to find a veteran and just listen to their story. And in the book, chapter 6 is about how to do this. Actually, most of the chapter isn't about how to do it. It's just explaining to civilians who are not therapists that it will help. There's a vast amount of research showing that social support from ordinary citizens is helpful, that there are other cultures in the world where the community expects to help people who've been traumatized, whether it's by war or a tsunami or whatever else, come back into the community and to listen to their stories and understand and create a safe place for them.
What are some of the statistics about this impact that the war is having on, we mentioned suicide, and you also mentioned homelessness. What are some of the actual rates? Because they're alarming how many people are being affected.
Well, I was at a conference this week that we put on at Harvard, at the Kennedy School, about veterans, and the numbers they were talking about were 18 veterans kill themselves every day. And these are not just veterans from the current wars. Vets from World War II have a higher rate of suicide. And so what we have in this country now is 23 million veterans from all these wars who have faced life and death in ways that the vast majority of the rest of us never have. And so the rest of us are living in an only partially aware state. There's so much going on that we don't have a clue about. And in order to be in touch with the fullness of our humanity and theirs, we need to connect with them and we need to listen.
Paula, what does the Veterans Administration need to do on a national level? What kind of changes are needed to really get us going in the right direction to really help veterans?
Well, that's such an important question, and it needs to start in the military, because they, of course, they're medicating people in combat to keep them in combat. They're medicating women who are mothers and who are desolate because they're over in Iraq or they're in Afghanistan and they're 3-year-old is left behind, and they go to see a military therapist, and more often than not, they're put on drugs for these deeply human, normal feelings. And we would condemn them if they didn't have those feelings. I would say, what kind of mother is that? So it needs to be in the military, too. But let me tell you, here's what's needed. The military and the VA need to get away from the traditional mental health system. They themselves are saying and documenting that it's not working, or at the very least, it's far from enough. And an organization called Veterans for Common Sense were so upset about the stories that they kept hearing from vets in the VA system that they would call and say, I'm suicidal, and they would be told, we can give you an appointment in 3.5 weeks. Or they would go and they would just be put on drugs, which sometimes precipitated suicide attempts or suicides. And so Veterans for Common Sense filed a lawsuit against the VA mental health system, and they said it needs to be overhauled. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, federal court in California, ruled a few months ago that the Veterans Affairs mental health system, they used words like shameful. They said the delays were egregious, that all kinds of things in the system were shameful, and they ordered it back to district court saying, you need a complete overhaul of this system. Well, the VA waited several months, and then what did they do? They didn't come up with a plan for an overhaul. They're using enormous amounts of money and resources to appeal the decision. I think this is unspeakable. And so what we have to know is that there are ways out there. There are people all over this country who are using other approaches, non-traditional approaches, for healing vets and helping their families to heal as well. Let me just give you a few examples. There's an organization called ArtReach Foundation. They work with trauma survivors all around the world, and they use the arts and literature and yoga and meditation and listening to stories to help people, to help veterans and their families heal. There's Monica Haller, who created on her own the Veterans Book Project. She goes around the country. She'll find a vet or a vet and their loved ones, and together they make a book of how war has affected them.
Paula, we're just about out of time, so remind people the title of your book and again how they can get in touch with you and find out more information about your really important work.
The book is called When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home, How All of Us Can Help Veterans. And please, you can get in touch with me through the contact form at my website, which is, again, whenjohnnyandjanecomemarching.weebly.com. Or I also write a blog for Psychology Today in which I address a whole lot of things, including veterans issues, and there's a contact form there as well.
Paula Kaplan, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Paula Kaplan. She's a clinical and research psychologist who has done landmark work showing the unscientific and harmful nature of psychiatric diagnosis. Paula is a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Women in Public Policy Program and the author of 12 books, including most recently, When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home, How All of Us Can Help Veterans. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. It's time for the headline news.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, December 1st, 2014. Today, the Supreme Court will hear a case that could have implications for free speech on social media. Anthony Alanis, a Pennsylvania amusement park worker, was convicted with making threats on Facebook and sentenced to 4 years in prison. His graphic remarks were directed at everyone from his ex-wife to an FBI agent questioning him. Under current law, it is a crime to transmit, quote, threats to injure, end quote. The court will have to decide if prosecutors must show that individuals have violent intentions or if it's enough that a reasonable person would interpret them as violent. Alanis maintains that he didn't mean to scare anyone.